Perfect. So, welcome back to the third to last. I don't know if we have a session tomorrow. Do we have a session tomorrow? Yeah. Who thinks that we are going to have a session tomorrow? Not we. I mean, I. Hands up. Who doesn't know? Who doesn't care? Who thinks that it's not the case? Okay, good. So, did we? I don't know. Cool. So check it out. It's all laid out in the organizational slides. So, we can all look up whether we are going to have one tomorrow or not. However, yes, good. Presumably so. Let me think. Let's look it up together. Why not? I mean, because that's a bit of relevant with respect to. Oops, that's not where I wanted to go. Social organizational slides. Okay, and there are the dates, time plan, lecture. Okay, so July the 2nd. Well, yeah, it's scheduled. Good. So why ever? I mean, I made the plan in the beginning to respect the total number of lectures so that it's 3V and not 4V or 3.2 whatever V, right? So that should kind of work out. Why I was referring to this was or is because I wanted to announce that in the last session, so next week, Tuesday, we're going to have a question hour, right? And the organization of that question hour will be that you are supposed to form groups, and whatever questions you may have, you're encouraged to discuss them in the group. And then if some group or some person does have questions, I will go to that group and discuss it there, right? Why? Because in the large audience, my experience is that people would normally not all of them would dare to ask questions that they presumably find stupid or something. So, and the second effect is that people, when they explain things to each other, then you'll learn. And that's a substantial truth, right? And I will go to each of the groups that has questions and will explain these things with them, right? So this session will not be recorded for those out there. So come in and join if you want. However, after the question session, I'm still here for questions as today, as tomorrow, right? So if in preparation for the exam, should you already have begun that, which I don't assume because it's very late in July, try to ask the questions then, okay? As for the exam, I will put out a fact sheet which tells you everything about the mode and the, well, required stuff and what you should use and what you shouldn't use and stuff like that today, right? I will put it on Piazza today so you can know everything about the exam, right? And if there should be any other organizational questions, as always, ask me, okay? Cool. So we left off precisely with ending up our considerations on social signal processing. So today's topic and the topic of tomorrow will be game theory or basics thereof, right? So why is that, and what does it have to do with social computing and social gaming, right? Surprisingly enough, game theory, as most of you will perhaps know, is not very closely related to actual games in the sense of games engineering in, yeah, seen from a certain point of view, right? From another point of view, it is related, and that's why I included it here in the lecture, social gaming, social computing. For the social computing persons, it is certainly so that this is a relevant topic towards, in yeah, or with respect to, in regard to understanding the respective papers out there in the field of social computing, right? So my goal is to allow you to understand current papers in social computing. And there is a lot of research going on in that field. You know that Professor Brandt is doing algorithmic game theory. There is others doing algorithmic game theory. And the connection to social computing is, well, at least twofold. So the first connection is that these sorts of formalized games that we will discuss now can be played, let's say, with two or three or four anonymous players that kind of try to optimize their utilities, right? And you can study things like Nash equilibria and all these phenomena. But there is a branch of research that investigates what happens if you play those games on networks, right? Because that's what we all do in our daily lives, right? May it be in business or may it be in the private sector. So usually you have your social network and you try to play games with people in a very first level sort of modeling. For example, when it comes to exchanging resources or news, right, in social computing, the whole point is that you contribute and others consume, and you consume the stuff of others, right? So the prosumer idea is at the very heart of social media, Web 2, and social networking, right? And you do this, in a sense, yeah, because of or by playing a game. Namely that you expect once you publish information or blogs or news or something that you would get back something. However anonymous this reward may be. So if you're a blogger, certainly your reward is more or less indirect. But the same is true for musicians publishing their videos on YouTube and stuff. So it has become a more or less a necessity in music business to be popular on the free web before you can get a serious contract. And the same is happening now with literature. You know, there's a lot of free literature platforms out there where people publish their works of their writings, right? Their stories, their books, their novels. And once they get a large audience, then they have a chance to get a contract. So we're moving at least partly in that direction, and it's always a game that you play. So you kind of deliver something to the public or to a specific audience, and you want to have something back. And that naturally is the case in business, right? And in a lot of other formalized interactions. And social networks come into play by the fact that you would play things with your acquaintances and not, or in some cases, at least with your acquaintances, and less probably so with total strangers. Yeah? That's not exactly true for business, right? Because small business research can safely assume that an anonymous customer and you as an anonymous seller kind of rationally behave, right? But in that social networking scenario, it is okay if you, let's say, lose 5 games and then win 7, right? So it is okay to first deliver something while not getting back something, and then maybe in the future count on, well, reputation, a contract for your books, and so on, right? So this type of games on networks thing is a type of formalized interaction that's becoming increasingly important on the web and in real life for a large class of people, right? So that makes it rewarding for people in social computing to reason about these phenomena, right? So I've recently read a paper about privacy that uses game theoretic considerations, because privacy is nothing more but a formalized way to state who is eligible to consume your content in a way, yeah, in a non-probabilistic model, right? So there's a lot of applications, and I think it is worthwhile knowing the basics of game theory. For the games engineering students, the same reasoning applies. I mean, if you're studying games engineering, I think it's, mandatory to at least know what the common ground and what the differences are with respect to formalized game theory. So this game theory lecture here just covers the very basics, so it's not intended to, take away something from Professor Brandt's and others' more specialized lectures. And it has two parts, right? The first part is based on a book by Michael Wooldridge, and it's called Multi-Agent Systems. It's a very good book about distributed AI, right? So robotics, agents, how they communicate, how they interact with logical frameworks, with whatever. Well, deliberation, task scheduling, task sharing, and so on. And game theory is one chapter in that book. It's very easy. It's very well written. So that's part A, which just introduces the basic concepts, right? And then there is a part B that I took from a book by Fudenberg and Tyrol, which is called Game Theory. And they're like the old grands of game theory, at least part of the stuff of old grands. And they, it's a rather thick book, and it covers almost anything about game theory. It's very concise, a bit more mathematical, and that's part B. There's a certain overlap between those two parts that I kept in there for you to have a good intro into these things, right? And everything is online, or will be online, all the resources, and I made also copies of the respective book chapters, right? So you can have all the background reading as usual. Okay. So what's the basic scenario in game theory? So it is about actions, and it's about utilities, right? It's about moves, if you don't like the term actions, okay? So in a very, very basic scenario, players choose their actions simultaneously, right? And the result of the actions they select will be an outcome in a discrete state space, or it will kind of act upon the world that they're in, a micro world, and change the common state of that world, right? And the combination, or the outcome, depends always on the combination of actions. That's what makes this so different from decision theory approaches, because actions, or the outcome, always depends on my actions as well as the action of other players. So this simultaneously is just the first simple sort of games. Then there is staged games. There is games of perfect information, where everybody knows everything about the utilities and the moves of other players, at least the principle space of moves, not the actual moves, of course, right? And then there is games of imperfect information, where you don't know all the details and you have to probabilistically guess and build expectations. So we have static games, dynamic games, and games of complete information and incomplete information. That makes at least four basic sorts of games that are discussed in Fudenberg Tyrol's book, right? And we're as you might have guessed, we're going to stick to the very, to the most simple case, static games of complete information, right? So for the moment, let's assume each player has two actions, C and D, where you might say C is cooperate and D is defect. So the environment behavior, that's a reaction to the actions of the two agents or the two players, is then a function which maps player I's action and player J's action to this discrete space outcome. Okay, so that's a very special, or not a very, but a special case, right? So this we would call tau, okay? And so there might be different cases, right? So in the first case, we see that for each strategy profile, as we will call it later. So the first one plays D, for example, and the second one also plays D. There is a state omega, small omega 1, as an output. And for other combinations, there's omega 2, omega 3, omega 4. And if we assume that they are all pairwise, disjoint and not equal to each other, then in a sense, the environment is sensitive to the actions of both players, okay? It could also be the case as in the lowest line where the action is only dependent, or the outcome, I should say, is only dependent on the action of player two, right? So whatever player one does, it is only of significance what player two or J does to control the outcome in the environment. Or middle case, if the always the same state results, then it is clear that none of the players has any influence, okay? And naturally, we wouldn't talk about the states of the of a world if it weren't connected with a utility, right? So in a state of the world where I'm lucky, rich, and beautiful, my utility is larger than in a state of the world where I'm poor, ugly, and, depressive. Well, you can imagine what's the case, what might be the case. However, it is the utility that operates on the world states, okay? So, for example, we could have that I's utility in state omega 1 is 1, or J's utility in omega 2 is 4, and so on, right? So, since this detour over these environment states is not of any significance for us here, it's more from the agent perspective, we could as well do this in a short notation. So the utility of player I when DD is played, meaning that I plays D and J also plays D, is 1. So that's the same as stating that tau of DD is omega 1 and UI of omega 1 is 1, right? So you can just leave out omega 1. That's the usual game theory notation in a sense. And naturally, there are certain preferences, right? So utility functions are usually things that people want to maximize, okay? So the preference in that case for player one is that she says that I would prefer CC to CD, right? At least weekly, because it could also be the same. And I strongly prefer this to all the outcomes DC and DD, right? And that's just by the values of that utility function. So these preferences are the things that count in a certain sense with respect to the outcome of the game. Because if the 4 here were replaced by 4,000, then the preferences would still be the same, okay? So it is these preference relations that count, right? So in a sense, since we're having this these utility function values for all the respective outcomes, and for player 1, we would have this preference relation here, we can see that C is certainly the rational choice for player one to play, because she prefers all the outcomes where she plays C to all the outcomes where she plays D. Okay, so, and for the second player, the same is true, right? Yes, because C here is C is also preferred to all the outcomes where the second player plays D, okay? Because C here is larger or preferred. So both of them would prefer CC, which means that CC, since it's the rational choice for both players, no matter what the other player plays, we would expect that the outcome of the actual game is that both play CC, right? That we might call a win-win situation in a sense, or a strict Nash equilibrium, as we will see, okay? So that's the easy case, right? So there are more complicated cases out there, okay? So typically, these things here are not characterized by lists of utility function values, but rather by something that is called a payoff matrix, okay? So player I is the row player, and player J then is the column player. So the utilities of J are denoted here, whereas the utilities of I are denoted here, okay? And you could as well write, instead of this notation, you could as well write this in such a payoff matrix, right? Assume that you know who's the first and who's the second, okay? And in that case, the second would be I, whereas the first would be J, okay? So that's more like a conventional matrix notation. We will use that later, okay? Good. So explaining those symbols, we say that Omega 1, which is a set of states, weakly dominates Omega 2 for player 1 if every outcome in this set of states is preferable or at least as good as every state in Omega 2. So here we would still have the detour over the environment states. But it's exactly the same as this, where we would take this short notation where this says if player one plays C and the second player plays C, then a result in the environment results, or a set of results, that is weakly preferable to the set of states that results when playing this. Okay, so you could as well formulate the preference on the sets of action profiles as well as on the set of environment states. So that's exactly the same. And this is weak domination if this is as preferable or more preferable, and strong domination is the case when environments are or outcomes are there which are strictly more preferable than others in terms of utility. Okay, and that's more or less a simple thing. What do I prefer? I prefer when my utility is larger, simply put, okay? And these actions in game theory notation or in game theory notion are called strategies. Now, that's a bit counterintuitive from a language semantics point of view, because strategy, as opposed to tactics, is normally something which points farther into the future, and in our typical semantics involves a lot of actions, right? So the nuclear strategy of the U.S. is to, whatever, respond to a limited threat or a limited nuclear attack by a number of whatever weapons, and to a major attack by this, and so on. So that's a lot of ifs and, yeah, series of actions. But here we would refer to a strategy as choosing a single action, period, right? And S star is then the set of possible outcomes when we play strategy S. Okay, that we would later on change in notation. Okay, so again, a strategy strongly or weakly dominates another strategy if the respective sets of outcomes strongly or weakly dominate this. We could as well say that the strategy itself dominates this too, just leaving out the environment states. Okay, so if we have such a case of strong domination, as we had before in the example, it is easy for both of the players to determine what to do, right? So I would always choose that strategy that optimizes my utility. And if a certain strategy is better than all the other strategies, then I would certainly do that. Okay, good. So it is rational to delete those options that are strongly dominated by others from the set of possible actions. Okay. For example, if you say, I have three choices, right? Keep on giving the lecture, my first choice. Second choice, keep on giving the lecture and start crying around. And the third option, take out a gun and blow my head away. Okay, so what option would I choose? So certainly the payoff in the third case is very low, right? So each of the others dominates the third, right? And the outcome of me crying around is also smaller for me because you'd think I'd be totally crazy, right? So the best option is to just keep on giving the lecture. That's what I'm doing, okay? Well, still I have a lot of possible actions at hand, yeah? Like undressing, tearing off my hair, dancing, but they are all strongly dominated. That's why I don't do them, okay? And, yeah, as I already informally introduced, we call we say that two strategies, so two playing options, or a single playing options for two players, is in a Nash equilibrium if, assuming that I play S, the other one cannot do any better than playing his option. Okay, so the two strategies are called S1 and S2. S1 is the thing that I play, and S2 is the thing that the strategy that the other player plays. And, assuming that means that anyone can assume that, myself as player I or the other one. So it's a game of total information, and it doesn't matter who assumes. So assuming that player I plays S1, player J cannot do better than S2. And assuming that player J plays S2, player I cannot do better than play S1, right? So in this case, for example, that we just had here, in this case with these dominance conditions, right? It is clear that once player 1 plays C, the other one cannot do better by as compared to also playing C. So CC is the Nash equilibrium here. So if the first plays C, right? The other player could play D, but that wouldn't increase her payoff. It would just leave the payoff the same, right? So the point is, I cannot do better than. Yeah? Doesn't say that other options could be equally rewarding. Okay. So the result is that in a Nash equilibrium, no player has an incentive to deviate from the Nash equilibrium, which is a comfortable situation. And that was, for example, a situation in the Cold War. And that's why the Cold War, in a certain sense, worked out, yeah, as a political concept. Because, well, assuming that the others do not start their rockets, I can do no better than also not start my rockets, right? And these things were, simulated a lot and thought over a lot, obviously, by the Russians and the Americans, since if they would have found a flaw in their reasoning, meaning whatever deviating strategy option would result in a better payoff for the others, then the whole system would break down, right? And that's why, for example, in the early or in the late 1950s, when the U.S. suspected that the Russians had their own nuclear weapons, there were a lot of U.S. militaries that suggested, let's nuke them down while we can, right? And fortunately enough, the president didn't listen to those idiots. It is all a matter of game theory, right? And since there is a certain modeling degree of freedom with respect to the rewards, to the utilities, and with respect to the possible actions, right? There is still some uncertainty in those things. That's why politics is never, well, can never be reduced to game theory, unfortunately. Good. So in a Nash equilibrium, we know what to do. It's easy, right? The problem is that not each of these games has a pure strategy Nash equilibrium. And there are a lot of games that have multiple Nash equilibria. Okay, so then it's not so easy from a certain point of view what to do. However, with respect to the first point, this is not true for our class of games for something that we would call a mixed strategy Nash equilibrium, where we would do probabilistic choices of actions. Okay, so every such game does possess a mixed strategy Nash equilibrium, at least one. Okay, so but there are still the cases where we would have several, and then it's not so easy to decide what to do. Okay, good. So there are some terms that we will encounter throughout the lecture. So we would call a scenario strictly competitive if player I prefers an outcome, if player J just prefers the reverse order, right? So this is just a competition. So for example, Indiana Jones finds the crystal skull and he wants to keep it for himself. So he prefers the state where he has the skull compared to the state where the other one has the skull, and the evil Nazi, whatever person, I've not watched that movie fully, would prefer just the opposite order of states, right? So that's a strictly competitive setting. It could even be worse. So preferring the reverse order doesn't say anything about the utilities, but if we have that the sum of the utilities is zero, we have the case that the amount of winning for, or the amount of utility for one winning is just the amount of losing for the other one, right? So the more I win, the more does the other one lose, and vice versa, right? So there is no such thing as you win, but at least I stay put, right? So this we might call a Pareto situation, yeah? It is just if you win 100, I will lose 100. So that's a zero-sum game, and we will get to this later, okay? However, strictly zero-sum games are realized only in real formal games. In the real world, almost all the scenarios are, or many scenarios are not strictly zero-sum. So there is a difference between rational analysis and your psychology, okay? For example, if you play games like the Ultimatum game or other games where it's upon you to decide whether you accept an offer by the other player, so that's like a two-stage game, and if you psychologically perceive the offer to be unfair, meaning that the other one would say, I get 80% and you get 20%. What about this, right? And you would always say, well, that's not fair. You would even deny this person his 80% if denying means getting nothing. Okay, so that there is an interesting psychology involved in those games, and there have been investigations showing, for example, that you are less willing to allow your personal friends to have a benefit than to allow strangers having that benefit, because in a sense your friends are your intimate zone where you want to have justice in a certain sense, and where you would always compare yourself to those people. So it hurts more to see all your friends prosper while you don't than to see some strangers prosper while you don't, right? So there's a lot of strange psychology involved there, and we would always have to separate the rational choice from certain psychological things, right? So that's why many encounters are perceived as zero-sum games, while they're actually not from a rational point of view, right? So let's do an example. And that's the most famous example in game theory, I would say, and that's the prisoner's dilemma. Who has heard of the prisoner's dilemma? Hands up. Who has not heard of the prisoner's dilemma? Okay, cool. At least some. So the story is, criminals, I should say. So they are criminals, and that's known. They're held in separate cells, so they have been captured both, and they're held in separate cells. And each of them has the chance of choosing either to confess, which means defecting in view of the other a criminal companion, right? If I confess to the police, I would in a sense betray the other mafia member, right? And the other choice is not to confess, but to really stay strong, not to confess, and that in this criminal code corresponds to cooperation. Yeah, so the mafia type of omerta style of cooperation, right? So I'm, as a criminal, I can cooperate or defect. And so, well, if one confesses and the other one does not, then the confessor is freed and the other one gets a very strong, a very severe punishment, yeah? So that's this thing that's called Kronzeugenregelung in German. I don't have the English word at hand right now. Does anybody of you have? Okay, cool. So we'll look that up. If both confess, the police or the judges just cannot prove that fully, but there is a lot of like indirect proof. So each of them gets a medium sentence, right? And if both confess, then the judge says, okay, at least you confessed, so we know what the truth is, so you get a medium sentence. If neither confesses, then nobody really knows what happens, and there are only these indirect proofs of guilt, so both get only 1 year, a mild sentence, because they could only be proved to have like an illegal possession of guns or something, but not the real true crime. Okay, something like that. So 3 years, 2 years, 1 year. So this is the payoff matrix. Okay. So these are the cases where one confesses and the other one does not. For example, here, I cooperates while J defects, meaning that J confesses and I stay strong in a mafia type of thinking. And here we have the case that both defect means both confess. So utility is medium, while if neither confesses, so both cooperate with each other, the utility is medium. Okay, so these are not the prison years. These are the resulting utilities, right? So 3 years corresponds to utility of zero, right? And being freed corresponds to 5 years. Yeah, sorry, not five points on the scale, right? So these are not years. These are points on the utility scale, meaning more utility is better. Okay. Now the question is, what should we do? Okay, so of those that have not heard of the Prisoner's Dilemma game, what would you do? Do you have a guess? Is there a rational choice? Sorry? So there's at least one guess, and the guess is there's only a rational choice if I know the other player, the other criminal, right? And I know what he or she is going to do, right? So this is actually not the case, but it's at least a good guess. So who of the other ones that have not heard, just one, please guess what's a rational strategy. Yes? So that's not true. If I confess and the other one does not confess, I'm freed and the other one gets the maximum sentence, right? Yeah. So that is true. So the actual rational choice is to defect for both players, right? So the Nash equilibrium is that both defect, right? Meaning that they have their mouth shut. So omerta is the rational choice. It is. No. You're kidding me? Are you the lecturer or am I the lecturer? We could switch, of course. I mean, I swear to God, meaning that I am sure by my life, yeah, that defecting is the Nash equilibrium. No. No, you didn't understand it. Sorry. Are you kidding me? If I tell you that you're not right, why do you keep on insisting that you are? I mean, it is so. Yeah, that's right. Okay, it's possible that I'm wrong. So I will take a few seconds and rethink it, okay? And you take a few seconds to rethink it, and then we would get this, okay? So, oh, absolutely you can. If I betray, so before you continue, yeah, so defect means to confess, right, to the police, okay? So I defect in a sense that I would, well, I could confess to the police, okay, right, and cooperate means to not confess, okay? Right? So that we agree upon. Okay, good. So defect and cooperate. And Yes. Yes, okay, good. If you put, yeah. Yes. You're right. Okay. I in that fashion I agree. So that I there was a misunderstanding. You're right. Okay. So So you were always considering both at the same time, right? In a sense. So let's understand. So that's D, okay? And that's C. Okay, so and the statement is that DD is the Nash equilibrium, okay? And that means that I can not do better than playing D, okay? So, why is that the case? You don't agree. to DD being the Nash equilibrium. Yeah, okay, good. So you're... Okay. Okay. I'm also not sure why we're arguing, but okay, obviously, yes. Good. So, whatever. So, this is just a notion. So, this thing here is also called, in the game theory, speak the sucker's payoff, because that's the case here in the prisoner's dilemma. The one that stays, that keeps his mouth shut while the other one confesses to the police would get the maximum sentence, 3 years. Okay, cool. So that's the sucker's payoff. Cool. Now, one course of reasoning is the following, right? And I presume that it's the one that you gave, okay? Right? So just cross-check, okay? So if I cooperate, okay, let's assume I'm player I, okay? And if I cooperate, then if J also cooperate, we get both a payoff of 3, right? So in a sense, 3-3 should be larger than 2-2. Right? So we could assume that this is the Nash equilibrium, but it isn't, okay? Because if J also cooperates, we get a payoff of 3. If J defects, I get a payoff of 0, okay? So that's my sucker's payoff. So the best guaranteed payoff when I cooperate is 0. So I cannot know what the other one does. At least in that reasoning, in that first iteration, right? If I defect, so I'm player I defect, my minimum guaranteed payoff is 2. Yeah. So if the other one also cooperates, if I defect and if the other one cooperates, I get 5. Now he has the sucker's payoff. If both, if the other one also defects, I get a payoff of at least 3. So the best guaranteed payoff when I defect is 2. Okay. So 0 compared to 2. So I would defect if I'm player I, right? And the other one would do exactly the same reasoning. You could as well do this with something that's called iterated strict dominance. So we had the concept of, yeah, weak domination. So if I just compare the columns and the rows, right? So 0 is strictly smaller than 2, and 3 is strictly smaller than 5. So my rational choice would be D, okay? So J knows that I would not play C, but rather play D. So he would have to choose between those two options. Yeah, if he also defects, he would get 2. And if he cooperates, he would get 0, right? So the reasoning is that this one, if you do this iterated strict dominance type of thinking, is the actual Nash equilibrium, okay? That's the reasoning. Now, the interesting question is, why don't those two people agree on CC? Because in CC, both have a payoff of 3-3. And if they both do DD, or if both play D, then they only have 2. So this seems irrational in a certain sense, right? But assuming that I, as the well-natured one, would try C, then the other one would certainly say, oh, he does C, so if I defect, I get 5, and if I also do C, I only get 3, so I would do 5. Okay, so in a sense, this is not stable, this type of reasoning, because we have this 5, which is larger than 3, right? So being an asshole pays off in a certain sense, or I should say being an asshole pays off at least for sure, to whatever amount, okay? And that seems to be a rather depressive type of thinking, and from an ethical point of view, it is, well, in a sense, some directions in our society that we are heading to are going into directions like that in a certain sense, because the absence of certain morals that used to exist and the retreat to rational choices and the sticking towards the paradigm of increasing one's utility can lead to situations like that, right? So it's a question what to do with that. But we would see that there is a solution, right, out of that, okay? Good. So here, intuition says CC is better, but it's a waste of utility if I don't defect as player J, okay? Good. There's other prisoner's dilemma type of situations. For example, the attempt or the game that is connected with nuclear arms reduction. Okay, so in those cases, if you think that through, it is rational to just not reduce. Okay, because the same reasoning applies. That's why the U.S. and the Russians had such a hard time starting with those start and sort treaties, and they had to use other, other types of reasoning, because the mere simple prisoner's dilemma like nuclear arms reduction game would yield to DD being the Nash equilibrium. Okay, good. Now, good. That's something I already elaborated on, but the question is that shocking Machiavellistic type of reasoning the final answer? But actually, it isn't. Okay. So, and the reason is we in real life we play the games multiple times. Okay. So, and if you play the game multiple times, then a different type of reasoning applies. Okay. And it is also true if you play these types of games on networks. Okay. Good. Why is that? Okay. Good. So let's consider this multiple times playing, and let's assume that the players can see the actual actions of the other player in past iterations of the game, right? So the payoff is paid out after each round, in other words, okay? So in that iterated prisoner's dilemma game, actually cooperating is the rational choice. Why? So if I defect, I know that the other one can punish me in the next round, okay? And if I test cooperation in one game, right, if I offer him or her cooperation, then if he punishes me, that zero sucker's payoff in just one iteration is not tragic, okay? So since this 3-3 is larger than this 2-2, I might be tempted to even offer cooperation multiple times, okay? And that's the same in every relation, in every marriage, okay? So it is not the case that once you have only one offer of cooperation and you're punished, then you would defect for the rest of your relation. So you would defect perhaps as a revenge, but then you would resort to offering cooperation, right? And since in the end, cooperation does pay out for both, it is the rational choice in the iterated prisoner's dilemma game, okay? Now, but there is a drawback to this. So if we play a fixed number of games and we play that N times, we can do something that's called backwards induction, okay? So for the last iteration of the game, I know that the second player doesn't have a chance to punish me, okay? So I would, in the last game, I would certainly, if he or she cooperates, I would defect to earn the 5 points, because I know he just cannot punish me, right? So that's in terms of marriages and relations, once the end is near, people start to behave really mean, right? So that's all these divorce stories and so on. If the perspective is really that they would never see each other again, there's just no incentive to be nice because the other one cannot punish me. So I would insist on each tasteless table that I once may have owned or something, right? So, and the interesting thing is that on the nth minus one run, right, we know that the nth game is spoiled anyway, right? So the n minus one game is the actual last game that happens, okay, the actual true game. And then the same reasoning applies. Since it's clear what will happen in the last game, since there we would have the DD Nash equilibrium, the n minus first game is the actual last game. So I can do the same reasoning, right? If the other one cooperates, I could just defect. And so that one would spoil everything from the end. Because if you do the reasoning from the end to the first, we would be left with DD all the time. DD, 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 DD. And in most scenarios, however, there is the lucky circumstance that you just cannot exclude that the game will be played again or will be played again multiple times, right? And that's something that keeps us from defecting in those situations because we have the suspicion that this might be a possibility, yeah? So in the end, if you just know that, well, after your divorce, you're going to die and nothing would happen, then it's just not rational if you're not morally, if you don't have any external moral from whatever religion or ethics, right? Just from the rational choice. If you know your life will end at the end, be an asshole, right? Just from a rational perspective, right? But fortunately enough, people don't know when their lives will end and they just don't know how many interactions they have, and that keeps us from being so mean, okay, in the rational theory, okay? Now, people tested that with algorithms, right? So there was early 1980s, there was a tournament by a game theory researcher that invited other researchers to submit code that would implement strategies for the iterated prisoner's dilemma game, okay? And there were several strategies that were submitted. For example, the rational choice, okay? So since this thing was played against, so each strategy would be played against each other strategy for a limited number of times, okay? So all D seems to be the rational choice if you take this backward induction type of thinking seriously, right? So there were people whose computer program just insisted in the line output D, program end, okay? And then there were people that tried with a random choice. There were things like tit for tat. That is something like, I would cooperate, and if I find the other one to defect, I would also defect. So that's severe revenge type of thing, but with still starting to cooperate, right? And there were more complicated strategies. For example, this tester type of thing, test the opponent with D. If he always responds with D, I cannot do something better. But if he sometimes does C in an attempt to offer me cooperation, I would just earn the 5 points. And, if he retaliates in that tester type of thing, I would resort to tit for tat. And if the opponent cooperates, I would, for example, play sequences like CCD to with that D ending to earn more points, yeah? Even more complicated programs around. And, sorry. And well, the total gain or the total utility was measured as the sum of the utilities against each strategy. Okay, so you would play against like 10 strategies, sum all your utilities up, and that's the result of your tournament. Now, what would you say won the tournament? Okay. Is there a guess? Yeah.
Tester?
Yeah. Just as a guess. Okay. What would be the reasoning? Yes? But is that really true? So if tester plays against all D, right? And tester, well, okay. Okay, if he retaliates, okay, I play tit for tat. Okay, meaning that tester in that case against all D would also resort to D. All D, okay, cool. Yeah, and?
Hmm?
Yeah, he would still get in those, where the random thing would play C, he would get the 5 points, and in other cases the 2, right? So this would be quite okay, right? But if you, well, actually against, if you took all the strategies that were submitted in those, in that tournament, and the goal was really to win the tournament, it was not just, like a, inputting some stupid strategy, right? And it turned out that actually tit for tat won the tournament, right? Because, well, just empirically so. And I certainly assume that there are reasons, there's reasoning against each strategy, what would happen as the one that you suggested. But in the end, if you take the overall utility, then it's better to be, well, someone that takes revenge, but start with cooperating offers, right? So that's also something that kind of governs politics in a certain sense, right? People tend to be very in favor of being, of taking revenge. For example, in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, everyone bashes at the other, right? So rockets from Palestine and Gaza, bombs from Israel, like bang, 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 right? However, well, these things, I would not go too far into that politics type of thing, but here, actually tit for tat was that, okay? And good, so there is some rules that Axelrod distilled from this tournament. So these are more like heuristic rules. So don't be envious. So it's not necessary to beat your opponent all the time to do well. And do not be the first to defect. So it's good if you start with an offer to cooperate. And don't be too naive. So if tit for tat kind of balances punishing and forgiving, okay? And it's in a sense it is fair. Okay, and don't be too clever is the last type of Axelrod rule, because there were programs that had whatever tons of lines of code and tried to employ whatever artificial intelligence was handy at those times in the 1980s, but they all lost against this tit for tat, which had like, I don't know, 7 lines of Fortran code or something. So yeah, well, whatever you make out of this, I think there are more sophisticated analyses available nowadays, but at least it's interesting from that perspective, okay? Good. So, and we could ask ourselves, okay, that was your suspicion, so if you knew your opponent, yeah, you could do better. That was your original suspicion. And this is a suspicion or a guess that is certainly true for human interaction scenarios, right? So modeling the other has some sort of utility gain built in, right? But for those types of game theory interactions, at least in that Axlo tournaments, it didn't turn out to be beneficial. Because at those times, the models were not improved by learning. They were just one model that you assumed, and then you would stick to that model. So these are a stubborn type of behavior, right? So I make up my mind about the world, and everyone's evil, and only my wife is good, and I behave like a stubborn idiot, right? And I buy a lot of guns to shoot everyone down that I suspect to be an evil person, right? So, and that's not learning. So those that offer cooperation should improve your type of thinking of these persons. And each person should have at least a certain credit, right? So that corresponds to offering cooperation in the first place, right? So if you had a type of learning, then things would be a bit different, right? Some of the strategies were just not forgiving enough, right, in a sense. And the third observation, in a sense, is that if you have a too complicated model, yeah, that corresponds in essence to random behavior, right? And that's in a sense also what men think of women and women think of men, because they make models of their respective behavior, right? And in essence, those models have to be so complicated that in many cases, random behavior or not having a model at all is as good as before, right? Just in the cliche type of thinking, right? And I presume that this is true for both sexes in the respective direction, at least cliche-wise, okay? Now, there are other symmetric 2x2 games, right? And, as you can imagine, each of those 2x2 games, meaning that you have a matrix that looks like this somehow, it has the only degree of freedom is the respective preference order that you could have, right? So there are others. So here we would have this preference order in the prisoner's dilemma. Then there is the game of chicken, which is, well, typically known from 1980s types of gangster movies where the hero drives the car and there's a narrow lane and the criminal also drives the car and they head at each other. And the question is, do you steer away or not, right? So if you steer away, then you're the chicken. And if you keep on heading towards the other, well, he or she might steer away, but he or she might also be stubborn and then bang, right? And so this is the game of chicken, has a different Nash equilibrium situation. Then there is stag hunt, which we will discuss, I think there are even slides. Okay, good. Yeah, so let's do this. And then there is simple variants, which are immediately clear, right? So here, defection dominates or cooperation dominates, okay? So stag hunt is, an old-fashioned game, and there are two hunters, and they can choose whether they would go for a hare or a small animal, right? And in essence, this corresponds to defecting, because the true goal is to go for the stag, the large animal. But the story is that the stag can only be brought down if both players cooperate, yeah? If the one would chase the stag and the other one would kill it, I don't know, right? So if both cooperate, then they would get the stag, so large payoff. And if one goes for the hare and the other one goes for the stag, the one going for the stag is just left with nothing because he needs the other one. And the hare hunter at least has some one or two small animals, okay? And if both defect, this is a bit, at least they would get one small animal if you want, okay? And It turns out that there are two strict Nash equilibria, DD and CC. So if you assume the other one is going for the stack, you can do not better than also go for the stack. And if you assume that the other one goes for the hair, you could do no better than also go for the hair, right? So there are different stories that produce the same game, right? And you can think of the respective reasoning there, right? And that's the game of chicken, which also has two Nash equilibria here, DC and CD, right? So since if they both steer away, they would both be the chicken. So if you assume the other one is going to steer away, the best you can do is to keep straight, because then you'll remain the hero, at least in the eyes of the cinema movie audience, right? And this is cooperation, so both are the chicken, and this is the fact, meaning not to steer away, which corresponds to a crash. So they would have they would both die. Yeah. So, and if you assume the other one is steering away, I would certainly stay straight. And if I assume the other one stays straight, I can do no better than steer away, right? Because otherwise my payoff would be zero, right? And that's that. Okay. So still some more time, right? Let's do a wrap up. Okay. So, this was just a first look into this game theory type of reasoning, right? So we saw several concepts more or less formally, like Nash equilibria, and we covered some example games just to illustrate the whole type of reasoning with a small excourse into iterated games. So iterated games would then be games with several stages. And if we have enough time at the end of the lecture, we will see that we would have to have a different type of Nash equilibrium notion, which is then called a subgame perfect Nash equilibrium, to cover those multi-stage games. Okay. Now, but before doing that, we want to dig a bit deeper into those simple one-stage games and treat them more formally according to the book by Fudenberg and Thoreau. That's why we would have to introduce their notation now. Okay, so first two slides are just about the notation of Fudenberg Thoreau's book. Okay, so first of all, we have a set of players from one to large I, right? And the example could be player one and player two. So that'll be the typical case here that we have. And each player has an index, and each player has a set of actions available to him or her. So this set of actions we will call a pure strategy space, large SI. And the index always denotes the player, right? So SI is the set of options that player I has. In this case, if the brown player is one, he has the options of doing U, M, and D. And yeah, in the same fashion, the other one can do L, M, or R, right? Standing for left, middle, and right, and up, middle, and down. Okay. And this M is not the same as this M. Okay, because, yeah, it's not only a different color, it's a different action, because it's an action that's available to player S2, right? So it can be the same, but it's not necessarily so, just because of the fact that it has the same letter, right? A strategy profile would then be some action that all the players choose simultaneously. In our case, we have two players. So a strategy profile is a two vector of strategies, S1 and S2, for example, DM. Yeah. So each strategy profile corresponds to one cell in the payoff matrix. Okay. It's just the same as we had before, now with that name strategy profile, right? That's for one play of the game. All the players choose simultaneously, and what they choose is, yeah, denoted in that strategy profile. Naturally, there is a finite space of strategy profile, which is built up by the Cartesian product of the single player strategy spaces. So, for example, in our case, we have a strategy space of 9 possibilities. As you can count here, right? And then we know we have a payoff function that gives us the utility for player I, for example, if the strategy profile S is played. Okay? So the utility of player I is not only dependent on his or her action, but on the simultaneous actions of all the players, as we had before. Because the simultaneous actions of all the players change the world, and the world's resulting state has a certain utility for me as player UI, or for another player, UJ, whatever, right? And in that case, UI of UL, for example, is 4. So UI of the combination UL here is 4, whereas U2 of UL is 3, right? Good. And one important notation, let's assume we have 5 players in the game. And I'm player I, yes, then the set of other players is always denoted with minus I, yeah? So these are 4 players, non-identical with me, that play something, and I would denote this with minus I, okay? And in our case where we would only have 2 players, right, so minus 1 would be 2, right? Because we only have 2 players. And that's an important notation if we discuss Nash equilibria. Okay? So, and then we know what a zero-sum game is. So the utilities just add up to 0. So it's perfectly fine to have negative utilities. And it's common knowledge, meaning that all players know the matrix, and all players know that all players know the matrix, and so on, right? So this you can iterate until infinity, and that's what you would assume, okay? Now, new to this notation is the possibility to have something that we will call a mixed strategy. And in contrast to pure strategies, which we will denote with the letter S, indexed by the respective player, or if it doesn't have an index, we mean the whole strategy profile that all the players play at this moment in time, right? And in contrast to these pure strategies, we would also have mixed strategies, which are denoted by the small sigma. So small sigma of I, what does that mean? It means a probability distribution over the set of pure strategy alternatives that player I has, right? So each of the actions, small as I, in large as I, is assigned a probability of playing that action, right? So for example, if I'm player 1, the brown player, yeah, I could have a mixed strategy that is like sigma 1 of U is 1/3, sigma 1 of M is 2/3, and sigma 1 of D is 0. So I would play action U with a probability of 1/3, and I would play action M with a probability of 2/3, okay? And I would play action D with a 0 probability, okay? And, that's just perceived as one action, yeah? So it's not that you say, okay, if I play something with probabilities, I would need several iterations, right? So if I play 30 times, then I would play on average 10 times U and 20 times M. Yeah? But that's not true. So a mixed strategy is a strategy for one iteration of the game, right? It's just that player one draws, samples this probability distribution, and that's his or her outcome, right? And the utilities would be computed with respect to those probabilities, right? So sigma I of Si is the probability that player I assigns to the pure strategy action small si. Okay. Good. So an example to give you an idea why this is important. So you know the game Rock, Paper, Scissors, which has variants with even three or five alternatives or other stupid alternatives. And what we see is that there is no pure Nash equilibrium, right? It's not the best strategy to play scissors or rock or paper, yeah? Because I can lose anyway, right? So there is no pure Nash equilibrium, but there's a mixed Nash equilibrium, because it's better to, if I assign probability one to rock and probability zero to paper or scissors, I'd be worse off than, or yeah, in a Nash equilibrium style, worse off than if I play a mixed Nash equilibrium with equal probabilities for each action, which kind of corresponds to randomly choosing one with equal probability, right? And that's why this game, in essence, is a good random number generator, right? So there's no chance to be clever, right? But this essence is somehow captured in the fact that the mixed Nash equilibrium here is one third for everything, okay? Now, we had a space of pure strategies, large Si, so we have a space of mixed strategies, that's a large sigma I, which is composed in the same way as before out of the single players mixed strategy spaces. And a mixed strategy profile would be a mixed strategy for each player that's played in one iteration. So sigma one is not a probability, it is the mixed strategy probability distribution that player one applies. And sigma two is the mixed strategy probability distribution or the mixed strategy that player two applies and so on, right? And the payoff of player I, when a mixed strategy profile is played by all the players, including I, is given by that formula, right? So we have the utility of player I of pure strategy profiles, S, and we sum over all pure strategy profiles, and we multiply the probabilities that each player assigns to his or her respective pure action. Okay, so this is nothing but an expectation. Yeah, this is an expectation over all the utilities taken over all combinations of pure strategies that could arise. Okay, good. And what we see is that it's a linear function of my probabilities, which will become important, right? And in a sense, it is sufficient to just regard mixed strategies, because a pure strategy would just be a unit vector in the mixed strategy type of thinking. So if I have three options, then this mixed strategy is a pure strategy where I'm sure to play option one, or where the strategy is to play option one. Okay, let's look at an example. Okay, so still we have our example payoff matrix, and we will assume that sigma one is given by one third, one third, one third, whereas sigma two is given by zero, one half, one half. And we want to compute the respective utility. So for player one, we would have to take the expectation. So it means that for each brown number we would have to pick up all the respective probabilities, multiply them with that number, and then add them up. So that's a expectation. So for example, the 4 here, right, has to be multiplied by the probability sigma 2 L 0, because this 4 corresponds to player 2 playing L. And I would also have to sum, to multiply my 1/3 that I attribute to the U that leads to that box here in that matrix, right? So 1/3 times 0 times 4. That's the one. And why we're having this multiplication? Because that corresponds to the logical end, right? So in probability theory, if we have independence, end corresponds to multiplying the probabilities, whereas or corresponds to summing them, right? That is, in a sense, this type of expectation that you form, okay? So in essence, if you just sum them up, you won for this, mixed strategy profile is 11.5. Okay, so that's the reasoning that you apply. Okay, and the reasoning is not that you actually sample from your probability distribution a pure strategy and apply that, and that's your utility, but rather a priori, you know that the only thing you can say is my expected utility when I play my strategy profile and when the mixed strategy profile and when the others also play their mixed strategy profiles, right? So that's a priori type of thinking here. And that's what will lead us to the notion of mixed strategy-Nash equilibrium, okay? That's the only difference to our first part, that we now can also have mixed strategies. Good, now, this matrix has been on for 5 slides, so what's the solution to that game? Okay, what should those players actually do? Okay, now, that's the reasoning. So no matter what player 1 does, okay, R gives player 2 a strictly higher payoff than M. Why? Okay, I would just have to compare. I'm player 2, and I'm thinking, and I say 2 is larger than 1, 6 is larger than 4, and 8 is larger than 6. So R is strictly better than M, yeah? No matter what the other player does, no matter what line is actually played by the other player, right? So player 1 then knows that player 2 will certainly not play M, because whatever player 2's reasoning with respect to L is, we don't know, he would certainly prefer R to M, so M is certainly not an option, right? So he would rather play R. We don't know what he considers with respect to L, but he would certainly rather play R. Right? So M is certainly not an option. So I know that I, as the brown player, only would have to consider the other player's actions L and R, right? And I would have to consider this brown column and this brown column. And now I will see that, I will see that U is certainly better than M or D, because 4 is larger than 2 or 3, 5, oops, U is better. Yeah, 5 is smaller than 8, but M has been ruled out, okay? So I would only have to take into consideration these columns. And 6, again, is certainly larger than 3 or 2. So player 2 knows these considerations of player 1, so player 1 will not play M, okay? No, he would neither play M nor D. He would certainly play U, okay? And once player 2 has made that reasoning, he or she can say that, okay, I know now that player 1 must play you, if he's rational or she's rational, and then I would only have to choose between 3 and 2, right? Because M has been ruled out. And then I would certainly choose L, because 3 is larger than 2, right? So we found that UL is a Nash equilibrium, right? Now you can say, come on, that might depend on the actual sequence, right? So I started with this M ruling out type of reasoning, and then all the other steps followed. But it turns out that it doesn't depend on the actual sequence, and we will get a reason for this in 10 seconds, no, not later, tomorrow, right? And that type of reasoning, this elimination process, is called iterated strict dominance, okay? And if you can apply iterated strict dominance, if that leads to one cell, you know that this one cell is the unique strict Nash equilibrium, right? And that's the luxurious case, okay? And however, it turns out that the luxurious case doesn't apply in many cases, right? But if it does apply, you're fine off and you have found the Nash equilibrium, right? Now, 1 minute. So the question is, why is it not dependent on the elimination order? So if some strategy is strictly worse than some other strategy, for me as player I, against some opponent strategy in a set D, then SI is also strictly worse than SI against any opponent strategy in any subset of D, right? So whatever I consider first doesn't matter, okay? Because if that if that strict dominance is the case, against some combination of strategies, then it's not a combination against some alternatives for the other player, then it is also better for some subset in there. And so it doesn't matter which one I'm considering first. Okay? So in essence, you can start somewhere, and if you're happy with iterated strict dominance, and if you end up in one cell, then everything is all right, and you're having a strict Nash equilibrium. So that's it, and we're going to take up from here tomorrow morning, at least with two of you or one, I don't know, and the other ones will listen to the recording. Okay, so see you perhaps tomorrow.